the culture.
Thank you. Thank you, Giorgio. And thank you for having me at this wonderful workshop. So I'm James Enlidis from University of California, Berkeley. And today I'm going to tell you about a problem that we really have just stumbled into in many ways. And it's the first time that I'm giving this talk, so it's fairly new to us. In fact, everything that I'm going to show you are things that we discovered this year. Just to briefly summarize the result, this is essentially what we've seen. We've got this material which is an intercalated transition metal dichalcogenide, so niobium sulfide intercalated with iron. And what we've done is that we've made what's effectively like a prototype device, which is what you see on the left. We pulse currents in the north, south, and east, west direction, and you essentially make a switch this way, which is what I'm showing on the right. So you have like high resistance and low resistance state that you can essentially switch between by just switching the direction of the pulse current along the blue and red directions. But, okay, so that's the basic result. And this is how I'm going to try and unfold that story. So first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about why I was interested in these materials to start with. So the category of systems that we're looking at and why we decided to look into those, and then finally how that made us stumble into an area that actually I'm not a community that I'm not really a part of at all. But anyway, we've nevertheless found something interesting. And then I'll tell you a little bit about the physics of these materials, from their structure, their magnetism, and then finally how we made these magnetic switches. Okay, and then end with what I think is on the horizon. All right, so let me tell you a little about the context. So for those of you who know me in the room, you know that I'm intrinsically interested in strongly correlated frustrated systems, like everyone in this room and in this workshop by the looks of things. So we've made contributions to areas like studying cationic spin liquids, Kagome's magnets that seem to also be wild semi-metals, and then in particular in this area, these triangular magnetic systems with chiral structures. So that was just an opportunity to advertise some of the recent things that we've done here. But the basic idea, or the basic motivation why we're interested in materials with frustration and interesting broken symmetries, is really because the relationship between symmetry and frustration is intrinsic, it's necessary. And the kinds of things that I mean is that if you obey certain symmetries in your material, you can often stabilize certain kinds of frustration. You allow certain kinds of interactions, and if you have a sufficiently low symmetry material, you can have multiple kinds of interactions that compete for the electrons to satisfy them. So in other words, symmetry can ensure that you have frustration in your system. So a good example is like broken inversion symmetry, or our Raspberry terms, or Jasielinski-Maria terms. In Kitaev systems, for example, it's the octahedral symmetry of the magnetic ions environment that allows similar exchange pathways and leads to strongly spin and isotropic exchange. In other words, symmetry can ensure different kinds of interactions, or low symmetry can ensure that different kinds of interactions are simultaneously present, and therefore you can kind of guarantee that you have some level of frustration in your material. And the combination of low symmetry plus frustration is what often leads to very interesting phase diagrams. Sometimes it includes spin liquids, sometimes it just includes very interesting spin textures. And so when I was trying to find the next generation of these interesting materials, I was looking for systems that satisfied those constraints. So not materials that I would expect the magnetic interactions to be frustrated, but also were low symmetry enough that you allow different kinds of interaction terms in your Hamiltonian that might play an important role. And that's how I came across these materials. The interesting consequence of doing that is that by looking at these intercalated dichalcogenides, which I'll tell you a little bit more about in the next few slides, we stumbled into an area that we really didn't know anything about, and that was the area of antiferromagnetic spintronics. Some of you in this room might have already touched on this in this field, because it's not a completely orthogonal community. But in principle, the idea of antiferromagnetic spintronics is different from normal spintronics, where you have heterostructures of ferromagnets and insulators. In that you're trying to basically leverage or move the antiferromagnetic domains or shift the antiferromagnetic order in some way by leveraging, by applying electric fields or currents in your material. In a similar way that you can kind of switch magnetic heterojunctions between one magnetic state and another in a magnetic drive, for example. Okay, but the reason why people are interested in antiferromagnetic spintronics is for a couple of reasons. First of all, you don't have any stray fields from your components because it's an antiferromagnet, so there's no residual field. So the result is that you can, in principle, pack your components into much smaller spaces without errors. The second part is that unlike ferromagnetic spintronics, antiferromagnets are extremely robust to applied magnetic fields. So you can imagine bringing them to highly noisy environments, like next to a magnetic motor in your car, for example. And then finally, you can also leverage the large exchange scale to make ultra-fast processes as well. So the trick has been, although this field of research has been around for maybe 20 or 30 years, the trick has really been trying to find materials where you can actually shift the magnetic degrees of freedom with applied currents or applied electric fields in order to have this kind of functionality. And that's been kind of difficult because symmetry plays an important role. So let me tell you a little bit about that. So first of all, the Edelstein effect. Some of you might have heard of this as the inverse spin galvanic effect. The basic idea is that if you imagine having a material with broken inversion symmetry, then if you can shift the spin populations somehow by injecting spin into the material, you can actually get a spontaneous current. The reverse is also true. If you apply an electric field or a current to a material, you can actually shift the spin population of a material as well and get an effective spin current as well, and that's what's known as the Edelstein effect. So in other words, if you have a system that breaks inversion symmetry, you can apply a current, and the result is that you can have an asymmetric spin polarization, which is given by this number P. And the cross product of whatever polar direction is present in your system and the current that you're applying.
It's electric polarization or P?
No, this is magnetic polarization. Okay. So it'd be like the spin direction.
Magnetic.
Yeah. They just use P in the literature. I know that's annoying, actually, now that I think about it. But yeah, it's magnetic polarization. Yeah, it's misleading. Okay, so one of the classic examples is what's known as copper manganese arsenic. It's one of two materials that do this. Now, this material actually doesn't break inversion symmetry, but when it magnetically orders, you can see that the two magnetic sublattices become connected by inversion symmetry. So in principle, any one magnetic sublattice breaks inversion. Does that make sense? So, yeah. Okay. And the second important equation in which symmetry comes in is what's known as the Landau-Gilbert equations, which is a way of describing how this current, this effective spin-polarized current going through your material, can actually torque the magnetization inside your system. And there are two terms. The left-hand term is often known as the field-like term, and the right-hand term, which is often known as the anti-damping term. And the idea is that if you apply a magnetic field or a spin-polarized current, you can actually torque the magnetization given by the derivative in time on the left-hand side in these two different ways. So M in this case is the sublattice magnetization, and H effective is either the applied magnetic field or it's the direction of the spin polarization of your current, which it kind of applies an effective magnetic field onto the system. So that's what HEF is. Okay, so what did they do with this material? They made this Union Jack type device, similar to what I showed you in the second slide. And what they do is that they apply what they call a right current in the north, south, and east, west direction, and then measure the response of the active area in the middle of the device there with these diagonal contacts. So the idea is that they pulse current along the red direction and see one resistance state, and then they pulse current in the black direction and see another resistance state. And this is what their data looks like. So it looks kind of sawtooth. Now the reason why it looks sawtooth is because of the following property. So as you'll notice between, each of the colors corresponds to multiple pulses in one of the directions. So all of the black dots are actually 50 pulses along one direction, and all of the red dots are another 50 pulses along the north-south direction. So why do you get the sawtooth-like behavior? Well, it's because the understanding is that in each one of these pulses, you're shifting the magnetic domains just a little bit in the same direction. So you're effectively detwinning the sample. And every time you pulse current, you detwin it just a little bit more. So each time you get like an extra small change in the resistance. And then when you're pulsing in the orthogonal direction, you're getting the other domain, or favoring the other domain somehow. And then each time you pulse a direction, you again favor more and more of the resistance state to be in that direction. Okay, so a couple of numbers to keep in mind. So first of all, the current densities they use are about 10 to the 6, 10 to the 7 amps per centimeter squared. And their pulse durations are of the order of, here they've got 60 milliseconds, so about 60 to 100 milliseconds or so. So very long, fairly long pulses with those kinds of current densities. So here's another material. I think it's the only other material that does this kind of thing, and that's manganese 2 gold. So this is another system with, I think in this case it was, it's a more complex magnetic order than copper manganese arsenic. But the point is that it's a similar kind of effect. You pulse the current in these two orthogonal directions, and then you measure the resistance state in the diagonal with respect to the pulse directions anyway. And here you see a similar question mark kind of sawtooth behavior, where now you're pulsing of the order of 100 to 200 pulses and shifting the magnetic domains in this way. Okay, so that's the basic. The two classic examples of antiferromagnetic spintronics, and that's essentially how they work, that you pulse these currents in these two different directions and you shift the domains by leveraging the spin torque terms in that Landau-Gilbert equation.
What's the temperature?
Good question. So, you have to be below the magnetic ordering temperature, number one, and the temperature in these ones is about 300 Kelvin, so they wanted to show room temperature functionality. But interestingly, as you go to lower temperature, the effect doesn't become better, it actually becomes a little bit worse. And I think it's because the magnetic domains are just that much stiffer, so they're harder to move. Good question. Okay. So in these two examples, because neither of the materials break inversion symmetry, it turns out that the dominant term that affects the spin torque in these materials is what's known as the field-like term. We go over the symmetry arguments later if you like. This term here, which is known as the anti-damping term, I'll just spend a little bit more time on because it actually requires like at least one broken mirror plane in the material. And the basic physics of it is the following. So the labeling is taken from different papers, so you'll have to forgive me, but basically M fixed plays the role of H effective in this case, and M, this precessing magnetic direction here, is the magnetic spin that you're trying to torque, basically, or that's the magnetic direction that you're actually torquing with this term. And the idea why it's called the anti-damping term is because there's always some tendency for this moment to cant towards the fixed direction. So in other words, the applied magnetic field or the polarization of the spin that you're actually applying with the current. But if your torque is large enough, so it'll go in the opposite direction using this term here. And what's interesting is that you can actually make it process so quickly that it'll flip direction. And that's what this globe is supposed to show you. So that globe is essentially showing the direction of possible, the precession path of this magnetic moment. And if your spin torque is large enough, in other words, if your applied current is large enough, you can actually make it cant and flip in the opposite direction. And that's the kind of thing that's that one would love to see in these antiferromagnetic spintronic systems. And in particular, the way it's allowed is if you've got a specifically low symmetry material to begin with. Okay. All right, so we need at least one mirror plane broken. Okay, which brings me to our systems. I'm not sure how much time I've got. I think I'm doing all right. Great. So the systems that we decided to look at were these magnetically intercalated transition metal dichalcogenides. And they're very interesting because they do, they are chiral, they are what's called enantiomorphic structure when you fully pack them, when you have the X on that index is actually 1/3. That's actually one magnetic, well, I'll show you in a second what that means, but the point is that when you have that filling, you actually get an enantiomorphic structure. So it breaks all possible mirror planes. So in principle, that should actually have these kinds of exotic torque mechanisms available to it.
Is chiral but still center symmetric?
No, it's not center symmetric.
When it's chiral, not center. When it's chiral, it's still center symmetric or not?
It's not center symmetric.
And 90 amorphs can be also center symmetric.
Okay.
Plastic and left plastic.
Okay, yeah, well, in this case, that's not the case. So in this case, it's chiral, and it breaks inversion symmetry. Yeah, so it breaks all possible mirror planes. What's also neat about these materials is that you're not really limited to just iron, which is the one that we focused on. You actually have a whole slew of transition metal elements that you can look at. They will also intercalate just as well. You can also change the transition metal for the Dutch chalcogenide from niobium to tantalum, molybdenum to tungsten, famously becoming these spin hall insulators, for example. And you can also change the chalcogenide from sulfur, selenium, tellurium. So there are almost an infinite number of possibilities, especially when you count stoichiometry as a variable, of the possible materials that you can look at. So we're kind of excited to get into this. But it turns out the iron one is complicated enough for one talk, possibly even too complicated for one talk. Okay, so you have this chiral structure. It's not centrosymmetric. It's centrosymmetric when you have a quarter filling, interestingly, so you actually can change the structure by just changing the stoichiometry. If you look down on it, it's just each of the transition metals are coordinated by a triangular prism, as you expect in this 2H niobium sulfide structure. But then the magnetic structure, so where the iron positions are, they form a triangular lattice, okay? So it satisfies those constraints that I was interested in, triangular system, possible frustration available, chirality, so lots of different types of interaction terms available. So that's why we got into these in the first place. Okay, it turns out a phenomenal amount is known about these series of materials. So for example, if you have chromium or manganese in these intercalated in these systems, you get exotic helical structures. If you have iron or nickel, you get some commensurate antiferromagnet in these materials, whether they're stripy or zigzag or whatever. And then if you change, even if you change the transition metal dichalcogenide to tantalum, you can actually get ferromagnets. So in other words, you can have all kinds of different kinds of antiferromagnets, incommensurate, commensurate, and ferromagnets, all in these series of systems. So I think there's a tendency for these materials to find lots of different kinds of ground states. And we're not the first to think that they're interesting. So it turns out that a lot of these materials were studied in the late 70s, and early 80s by none other than Stuart Parkin and Richard Friend. And they have a treatise on all of these materials, which are a couple of volumes, and they've cataloged them all. And in fact, some of the magnetic structure has also been done on these materials by none other than Hugo Reichfeldt himself. And you might ask, with these heavy hitters already having populated the space, why would somebody want to get into this field and think that they're going to see something new? And I came across this article in the Journal of Cell Science, and I think that probably answers the question why I thought I could actually make some progress in this field. All right, sometimes what you don't know can actually help you. Okay, so let's see what we find for these materials. So first of all, the first discovery was to do with the magnetism of the system. We found a spin glass for stoichiometries under 1/3. So if you actually dilute the system with iron, or actually later, as I'll show you, have excess iron, you actually end up having a spin glass. And the way you can start to see this in the magnetization, so here I've got magnetization curves for four different types of intercalation, not changing by very much, but by 0.33 to 0.28. And what you see here in the dotted and solid lines are the zero field cooled and field cooled magnetizations. And in the classic spin glass signature, these start to split, essentially. Okay. The other classic parts of signatures of spin glass behavior is, of course, relaxation. So you can look at the magnetization of these four different types of intercalations. As a function of time, you can see it decays logarithmically slowly, which is, again, a signature you expect of a spin glass. And the only one that doesn't do that is the one that's right on stoichiometry, the 0.33, which doesn't have any relaxation and doesn't have any difference between field-cooled and zero-field-cooled curves. The other thing that you can check is whether there is any memory effects in these materials. So what we did is that we cooled these curves, these materials down. We stayed at a particular temperature for an hour or so. And then this is at zero field, by the way, so no field applied. And then cooled it down, then warmed it back up. And it remembered, you can kind of see in the raw data, these tiny little steps. Here we have a background subtracted version. Basically, those steps occur exactly at the temperature that we paused. So it remembers that we, for some reason, waited at a certain temperature for a certain amount of time. And that's, again, a classic signature of a spin glass.
So delta is negative.
Excuse me? Is what's negative?
The delta,
delta is negative, yeah, that's right. So I had originally written these slides with 1/3 minus delta, but since I've got the other direction as well, I decided to do plus delta, and yeah, so delta is negative in this case. Exactly. Okay. We did notice something interesting about these materials, is that we were looking at what's known as exchange bias. So here down here, you've got like a hysteresis loop of the magnetization. And what we found is that it was always off-center. And it's off-center, we believe, because of an effect known as exchange bias. This is because there are two order parameters present, the antiferromagnetism and the spin glass. And essentially, they talk to each other, and one pins the other. Classic exchange bias behavior is when you have an antiferromagnetic layer touching a ferromagnetic layer, and the antiferromagnetic effectively pins the magnetization of the ferromagnet. So when you sweep the magnetic field up and down, you actually have like an off-center hysteresis loop. Well, we see the same thing in this material, but it doesn't have layers of different materials. It's just a coexistence of spin glass and antiferromagnetic behavior. Now, to prove that, we did some detailed NMR studies in collaboration with our friends in Tallahassee. And what you see is that high temperature, you get all the niobium nuclear spin states, and there's 9 of them, and they split in two because there's spin split and an applied magnetic field. And then as you decrease the temperature, they just turn into a big broad peak. This is approximately where you see the spin glass, where you don't seem to see any features at all. And then at sufficiently low temperature, you see two very broad peaks, which are what associated with, normally there'll be delta functions in a pure antiferromagnet, but because it's a now disordered antiferromagnet, you get two broad peaks. But in other words, we thought that this was pretty convincing evidence that one, antiferromagnetism was still present in this material, and two, because of all of our other data, clearly it's a spin glass, so these two things coexist in this material. That's really the only take-home point of this section, the coexistence.
Is it the same volume or is it separate?
They're in the same volume. Yeah. Okay. So, and again, I think we can get that from the NMR data because you can actually sum what the spectral weights are for each of them as a function of temperature and then see how it evolves and show that it's conserved. Okay. So now let me take you to the switch. So one of the very first slides that I showed you. What we decided to do is leveraging the fact that we knew these materials were chiral and they had lots of different magnetic states to choose from, maybe we could have applied electric fields or currents coupled to this magnetism in these materials. So we focused ion beam etched these systems. Usually they're made out of thin films, but we don't have thin film capabilities. So what we did is that we made lamella out of these materials. This is all false color. So it's one single crystal, and we just cut out these little arrows so we can have this Union Jack type device in honor of my English colleagues, who are extremely proud right now to be English, I think, you know. Pardon? Okay. So the different colors are the red and blue directions of the right current. So they're the ones where we're pulsing a bunch of current to actually what we think we're going to do is move magnetic domains. The way we're going to detect whether we actually have moved those magnetic domains is by pulling a very tiny amount of current in this direction here, and then measuring the resistance in the perpendicular direction. So the way to think about this, or the way I think about it, is that imagine that you have so much current that you utilize this Edelstein effect, this inverse spin galvanic effect, to actually move the magnetic domain. Then what you've done is effectively rotate your conductivity tensor, right? Because now it's easier to pass current along one direction than another direction. The result of that rotation of the conductivity tensor, is that now you end up having a perpendicular component, right? Because your electric field and your your current direction and the principal axes of the material are not perfectly aligned. Okay, so the result is that you actually end up getting a signal in the perpendicular direction. It's not the Hall effect. I want to make that very clear. But it is like a perpendicular conductivity. Okay, and this is exactly what we see. So we pulse the blue direction, we get a low resistance state, we get a pulse the red direction, we get a high resistance state. So presumably we're like switching these the resistivity tensor, the principal axis of the resistivity tensor as we're doing these pulses. I can look at the temperature dependence of this effect, and you can see that it turns on right at the nail temperature, so the magnetic transition of this material, and then it just becomes bigger, a little bit like an order parameter, the magnetic order parameter of the system. We can also apply magnetic fields, and we can see that the switching behavior basically is strongly suppressed by about 14 Tesla or so. But you immediately notice one big difference with copper manganese arsenic. We don't have any dependence on pulse number. So we've only done a single pulse in these materials, and we've completely saturated the effect, which is not like we saw in the other two materials, copper manganese arsenic and manganese 2 gold, where every pulse took you to a different resistance state because you're progressively moving these domains. I don't know the answer to this, but I have some ideas that I'll talk to you about it towards the end of the talk. Okay, the other important thing, I don't know if you remember, but the currents that we need are about two orders of magnitude smaller than what you need for these other two materials. So there you needed about 10 to the 6, here we need about 10 to the 4. Ah, thank you. The pulse width is also about an order of magnitude smaller. So we have about a millisecond in our pulse width, whereas you needed about 60 to 100 milliseconds, or at least an order of magnitude smaller than what we had in these other materials. The only difference is, of course, is that we're not at room temperature. We're at 40 Kelvin. But other than that, it's really interesting that you have the same kind of effect with completely saturated switch resistance at such low current densities and short pulse widths. So we thought that was kind of cool. Okay, so I'll show you this a little bit quickly, although it's kind of important. And that's, we looked at anisotropic magnetoresistance. So for those of you who aren't familiar with this, what you're doing is you're applying a current through your material and then measuring the transverse voltage and then seeing, basically, rotating the magnetic field in the plane and seeing how the signal changes in VXY. This is what's known as anisotropic magnetoresistance. Oh, okay, that was a waste of time. That was the magnetic field rotating in the plane. Okay, and you can basically make a plot of how, a polar plot of how the resistance varies as a function of angle, and you'll always get something, well, and you'll get this this beautiful flower shape, which is basically a manifestation of what's in this plot here. That you'd see in almost all ordinary metals or magnets or any material, really. And it's understood to originate from spin scattering. There's one big difference with what I've shown you here for our data. So we have the same effect. The only difference is that we're not actually rotating our magnetic field in the plane. What we're doing is that we're cooling our sample in a particular direction and turning this field off and then looking at the resistance state in the transverse direction. So it basically remembers not only that we cooled the material in field, but also what angle the field was at with respect to the plane. And that's what you're looking at. That's what we call the zero field anisotropic magnetoresistance. So basically has a memory. Why did I want to show you this? Well, because you can look at the angle dependence of this anisotropic magnetoresistance, And you can compare it to the angle dependence of your switching. So in other words, you can change the directions of these of the switch. So what directions in the material you're actually pulsing, and then whether you're measuring the longitudinal resistance or the transverse. And what we found is that it has exactly the same angle dependence as the anisotropic magnetoresistance. The quick way to summarize that: applied current has exactly the same effect on the resistance state as an applied magnetic field. So J and B affect the material in exactly the same way. Okay, so they which is perhaps a little surprising since they transform as different symmetry objects. Okay, so field and current always switch the material in exactly the same way, at least for this doping, and you can probably anticipate the complication, is that now we can look at all of this stuff as a function of doping. So we can change the stoichiometry, go to a perfectly stoichiometric system, we can go excess, we can go dilute, and this is the heat capacity and magnetization. And this is something that we found for the perfectly stoichiometric system. This is the anisotropic magnetoresistance. And what we found is that below the transition temperature, the anisotropic magnetoresistance has one symmetry, but then as you cool it down, it switches sign. So this is very weird. I don't think I've ever seen this without a phase transition itself. What happens to the switching, you might ask? It does exactly the same thing. It's not quite as stable as it was for the doped samples, but you can see very clearly that whereas at low temperature, the red pulse takes it to a high resistance state and the blue pulse takes it to a low resistance state, by the time you get to high temperature or higher temperature, it's exactly inverted. So there's a sign change in the angle-dependent in the anisotropic magnetoresistance, just as there is in the switching. And you can do this as a function of doping, and you see a beautiful evolution. So first of all, the AMR, the anisotropic magnetoresistance, evolves to a point where it has one particular sign at dilute for a dilute system. It switches signs of function temperature in these near stoichiometric systems, and then by the time you get to the overdoped system, you've actually gone back to the original sign, which is quite interesting. It's not quite the same for the switching. The switching has one sign for low doping. You go through this intermediate phase where you're switching signs as a function of temperature, but then by the time you get to the overdoped systems, you actually have the opposite sign of the switching as you had at the low doping site. So as you can imagine, it was pretty difficult for us to keep track of all of these signs. So I have, I think, a plot here that makes sense of all this. So the positive vertical axis actually tells you the sign of the AMR and the switching. And basically what you find for the low doped, which is the top slides, and the high doped, which is the bottom slides, is that they're exactly in phase, and as you dope more, they're more in phase, suddenly they become out of phase, and then for the overdoped, they're back to being, they're completely out of phase. So the switch to now, for these overdoped systems, the applied magnetic field and the current have exactly perpendicular effects. Okay, oh great. So I run out of time completely, so let me skip this part. I'm skipping the part that you featured in, Nick, sorry. But we do have, I think we got an idea about this, and I know I'm over time right now. But the idea is really just to think of the dilute and excess spin glass as like an electron hole symmetry, where they just have opposite signs. So if you imagine, and maybe it's because the actual interaction that's mediating magnetism between the magnetic sites is IKKY-like, which, as you may know, changes sign as a function of distance between the magnetic sites. So, for example, let's say you're in the dilute site, and you apply, and your average correlations, let's say, have one sign, let's say they're ferromagnetic, then maybe the way the Edelstein effect actually affects this ferromagnetic-like spin glass, or ferromagnetically correlated spin glass, is actually to pin domains in one particular direction. But now, if you go to the opposite side, now let's say you've got anti-ferromagnetic correlated spin glass. Then the right, instead of the field orienting the magnetic moments, it's now going to be like a spin-flop transition, which is going to orient the moments in exactly the opposite direction of the current. And now maybe because of this opposite correlation between the two spin glasses, you now have a different orientation of the magnetic domains. Okay, so let me just flick through this. We also see half plateau magnetization saturation. And finally, I think that's on the horizon will really tell you if you can actually interface these kinds of systems with other kind of Dirac cogenides and actually switch their properties as well, will be very exciting. So with that, let me thank you, and in particular, the people in charge of this project, which are highlighted here. And I should say that this project was actually started by undergraduates, so we value them in our group too. So thank you.
Thank you, James, for a nice talk.
Questions?
Can you say a few words about in the overdoped case, where the ions are going? And I mean, you had cartoons there at the end. How much do you know about that?
The short answer is we don't know where they're going. But then not in the plane of the niobium sulfide. So there have to be, so we've done some extensive TEM studies. And there we see the ions still being between the niobium sulfide planes, but between the other ions.
So how thick are the samples? They're two-dimensional like, but are they?
They're very thick. So they can be up to, for these particular systems, we have like half a millimeter to a millimeter thick. Well, thick by our standards. Yeah. And they can be 5 millimeters on the plane, actually. They're huge, huge crystals.
What's known about magnetic structure below nil temperature? Is it anything new?
Yeah.
In particular, I'm worried about this neotropic magnetic resistance because you have, in principle, your material has threefold symmetry. Your device, your artificial device, of course, has fourfold symmetry, but material itself has threefold symmetry.
That's right.
So if magnetic order breaks threefold symmetry, then of course I can get fourfold symmetry of anisotropic magnetic resistance. Otherwise, I don't understand why it's anisotropic magnetic resistance is fourfold, whereas material is threefold. It might be that magnetic order is something like making artificial square lattice out of this kind of
maybe
crossing
so
stripes.
What's known about the order is that it looks a bit like this. This was done in 1971 for these materials. And as far as I know, it's the only magnetic structure characterization. So what you see is that any plane has a kind of a zigzag type order, which in principle can be modeled by, I guess, an orthorhombic unit cell.
Why you have such perfect fourfold symmetry in your anisotropic magnetic resistance? Despite the material itself, all triangular.
Well, I don't think that's really set by the, well, I need to think about this, but that in principle, I think any of the anisotropic magnetic resistance data that have seen, it basically relies on the symmetry of the current and the cross of the current in the magnetic field. So it's not like in principle, it's not sensitive. So you could have an amorphous material, for example, and you still have fourfold symmetry.
Your device is fourfold, I understand.
That's right. But even like when you cross the magnetic field and the current, and maybe we should talk about this afterwards offline. But I think in that case, you still have to preserve like that same kind of fourfold symmetry because in principle, like let's say you're not detwinning the sample and you just have an average of all three domains, right? Then in principle, it's like a homogeneous sample.
There's another question here.
But we can talk about that. But I don't think it, anisotropic magnetic resistance actually, just because it's a threefold symmetry implies that you have the same symmetry in the AMR.
I'm not sure if it's true, but I would naively expect that if when you lose the mirror symmetry of your material, you should have a different signature in plus I pulses versus minus I pulses that you shouldn't have in the material you used in the beginning.
Yeah, we don't. Actually, plus and minus I are the same have exactly the same effect. Of course, yeah, yeah. So that's actually a very interesting idea. Initially, we didn't know whether, because there's a difference between what's happening microscopically, like let's say what domain you're preferring, and then what you're measuring, right? We're measuring something that's symmetric with plus and minus. But you can imagine that a current in that direction orients moments, let's say, like this, and then current in that direction orients moments like this. As far as the resistance is concerned, it might be exactly the same. So that's the kind. So we're not sure whether you're actually seeing a difference, but the measurement is symmetric. The detection is symmetric.
Very good talk.
Thank you.
I remember in copper manganese arsenide case, there are symmetries that are broken with spins rotating. Like, if I remember correctly, it's a glide plane that breaks. Do you have anything here like that? And I believe they see fourfold AMR, if I remember correctly.
They see fourfold AMR, but they're tetragonal, so it's a tetragonal system, so it just shouldn't be an issue. But and actually, they see a similar matching between the AMR and the anisotropy of the current direction as well. But to answer your question, the symmetry considerations there is that once you have the magnetic ordering, then in principle, one magnetic sublattice is associated with a different polar vector than the other one. So in the absence of magnetic ordering, the magnetic sites are connected by inversion symmetry. But in the presence of magnetic ordering, they're now distinct. One belongs to Z up and the other one belongs to Z down. So that was the argument that they made in their paper, and that's why they felt it was the field-like torque term that was actually dominating, because the field-like torque term would then basically match the symmetry of each, it would have the same direction of torque on one sublattice as the other one. So it would have the same symmetry, basically. I can take you through that argument in more detail because it's a bit subtle.
Yeah. James, in one of your last slides, you said you would like to combine different structures. Do you mean, for instance, if you use an iodine diselenide, you have the 1T structure, and then you have charge density wave.
Right.
Is this what you have in mind to come?
That's the kind of thing we have in mind. We also would like to make, that's exactly the kind of thing that we have in mind. So things that are closely lattice matched, but actually are a different species, maybe. So it could also be molyselenide or tantalum selenide on top of it. So one of the things that I'm interested in is really because niobium selenide is a famous charge density wave material. It would be interesting to see how that can be coupled to this kind of switching of the magnetic domains.
Further comments, questions?
So, I mean, in general, the TMD materials, despite the van der Waals, the interlayer interaction is supposed to be small because it's a van der Waals interactions, but empirically, we know that depending on whether you have single layer, two layers, and so on, the structure changes as well as some magnetic property changes. Some of them can be ferro along the C-axis, you know, go like chirals, and some changes something else. So I wonder, because you said that the thickness is quite big compared to
of the single crystals. Of the single crystals, they're quite thick.
So when you say anti-ferro, what is anti-ferro exactly in a plane versus the C-axis?
Well, I guess this picture is kind of helpful. So you can imagine that for a single plane, you have two different spin species up and down. And then in that case, in a single plane, you can see the propagation vector of the antiferromagnetism is in the plane. The question is it antiferromagnetically correlated interplane or is it ferromagnetically correlated? But actually the planes are offset a little bit here, right? So between one ion layer and the next ion layer. So, but if they were on top of each other, then you could quite easily define what means antiferromagnet interplane and ferromagnetically correlated interplane, because they would have the same spin orientation.
So, is there a minimal exchange model that explains that structure that you've illustrated there?
The magnetic structure?
Yes.
There's been a surprising, and this is an opportunity for the theorists in the room, there's been a surprising dearth of calculations in this field. In fact, I haven't seen a single one. And maybe this answers the question that we're working with our DFT collaborators to try and work out what the minimal model should actually look like. But they apparently are really struggling to figure out what the right interaction is. And I think it's, pardon? Why? Just because it's triangular lattice and low symmetry? Or?
You are doping now, we have different dopings, and you have to be very careful, you have to know exactly how this doping is going on, and so it's not a one afternoon calculation, definitely not.
Yeah, of course, but even on stoichiometry, I feel they can't even, so for example, the degeneracy apparently of having spins aligned in plane and interplane, pardon? It's a metal, yeah. Right. So basically, they can't even really tell whether they're supposed to be in plane or out of plane. Was the
That's an experimental question that can be
resolved. It's true, but even wait. But it does pertain to your question of what the minimal model should look like. So what whether the exchange interaction is purely in plane or whether there's a strong interplane interaction, which I assume is what one of the questions that you're is at the root of your question. So. Right now, what people assume is that it's an RKKY interaction where the dominant density of states comes from the niobium sulfide, and that's what's meeting the interaction between the ions.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So I guess we have to move to the next talk. Let's thank James, if you can.